This is George Ibbotson, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 8th of June 2012. George Ibbotson, part two.
One or two questions just relating back to what we were talking about. Were you in any other way aware of the International Geophysical Year, apart from having to do the extra SOND readings?
No. It more or less came out of the blue. I think I must have known that IGY was in the offing. And that we would be down there for IGY. But what it entailed, no idea until the time came.
You were also there at the time of the Transantarctic Expedition, weren't you?
I imagine I was, yes. It was Vivian Fox, you mean, yes.
But that didn't impinge on your consciousness particularly?
No. You mentioned earlier on something about Halley, whether they did science. I believe now that... In hindsight, that maybe Halley did do some radio sound work during the IGY. I think you're right there, I think. But
Was there a great sense of isolation then? Or were you aware of what was happening elsewhere in the world?
I know that when I first arrived there and the Shackleton set sail to sort of never to return, as far as I was concerned, I thought to myself... What have you done this time and let yourself in for? But that soon passed because the time didn't allow and the work didn't allow. And once we'd bedded in, it didn't bother me anymore. But of course, at that time, the BBC did a programme, a radio programme called Calling the Antarctic. And your nearest and dearest at home were called along to the nearest BBC studio to make a recording, and that was broadcast to all the bases, beamed to all the bases. The members on base, in turn, were allowed to select a musical item to be played on the programme as well. But that was the one programme, in fact, possibly the only radio we listened to was Calling the Antarctic.
So did your parents appear on that?
My parents, yes, and my niece, to my embarrassment. Wow. Hello, Uncle George! I cringed at the time, but however, she was there to meet me when I returned to Southampton. So I can't. She's very fond of me and I'm far fond of her.
There wasn't much space for them to say anything significant, or was it just a quick hello?
It was. It was, I would say, 2 minutes at most.
Yeah.
Really. Because they had to cram, I don't know whether it was every month, year round, or whether it was only during the winter months, possibly. And I imagine with the changeover, of course, they couldn't very well do it. It was too early. So they had quite all the bases to get in and all the people on the bases. So you're talking close on 100 people, maybe.
But they wouldn't deal with everybody in each programme, would they? Or were you told in advance which week you were going to...
Oh, you're told which... Yeah, you knew which one to listen to.
Yeah.
That was going to be yours, yes. I would say hard luck if somebody was out sledging, surveying at the time. But presumably they knew well enough in advance to make sure that they were, you know, they were back on base in time to listen to it.
So would this programme be listened to en masse?
Yes, yeah.
Hence the embarrassment.
Yeah. And I can remember... was it Drummond Matthews... And he said, "Hello, Drum, this is Mum." And we said, "I bet he's cringing." But it was things like that, you know. I think I wasn't unique in that respect, and maybe, but you shouldn't got over it. It didn't bother. They didn't drag you for it anyway.
But did you tend to forget about the rest of the world, or were you listening to?
Oh yes, we didn't had. I had no idea what was going on outside. I came back to the UK, for instance, totally ignorant of the latest pop music, no idea at all.
So Bill Haley never made it to the Antarctic.
No. As far as I can recall, as I say, the only radio we listened to was Calling the Antarctic. And whether that was because we didn't have a wireless as such, we had radio equipment and it could pick up beamed programmes. I don't know. Let me see whether the BBC World Service would have been accessible down there. I have no idea. But it quite possibly wasn't. The only people we could speak to were Stanley. And with Stanley, once a month, we were allowed to send a... What happened was the Wallisop would send your written letter over the air to Stanley, and somebody would type it out and send it by email to the UK. So, yes, there were letters coming in and going out in that respect. So
well, these are very short, weren't they?
Oh, very short. I think it was about 100 words, maybe that, maybe not that even.
Did you struggle to fill those 100 words, or was it easy?
Oh, they would never, because there was always something different to tell them. I mean, so you might argue that, well, the second year round, that everything is the same. You could just repeat yourself, but they probably forgotten it by then. Anyway.
Yeah, you, of course, there were occasions when you were interrupted by the outside world. And I'm thinking particularly now of Prince Philip, God bless him. He'll be 91 this weekend.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what the event was, but I know he and the Queen parted ways. And I believe he stayed on Britannia, and she was maybe somewhere in South Africa.
They'd been to the 1956 Olympics in Australia.
That's what it was. But he was on Britannia, though, was he? That's right.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, Britannia never got as far south as you.
No. It didn't?
No. So what? He would have come on a
protector or something like that?
Yeah.
Oh, right. I said, just to say, boy, my memory's a bit hazy. What I do remember is that there we were with our shirts all nicely ironed and freshly shaven, and himself came ashore red-eyed and with a two-day stubble. I think maybe whether he'd been celebrating something in the wardroom that night, I don't know, the night before. But he came and it was a quick hello, goodbye, virtually, you know, because I imagine he was, how many bases, whether he called it all of them, I don't know. But I imagine he had to move on, you know, time was precious. But yeah, so it was nice to meet him, anyway.
He didn't stay for a meal?
Oh, no. It was come ashore. He didn't go beyond the hut. And then it was in one door and out the other, virtually.
Did he meet all the men?
Yes. As I say, the picture, photograph I've got of him coming out the front door. He must have come in the back door, I think, and worked his way down and said hello to us all the way. I think they probably showed him the radio sound room and things like that, but which is probably different from the other bases, but something he's probably seen dozens of times before, radio sound. Because it used to strike me that if the BBC had got a new producer, a young producer in training, go and do an item on the weather. And because we used to get, not down on bases, I'm saying, but in the UK, so many visits from coming along. And the young producer would say, do this, do that, do that. And the cameraman, who I'd seen many times before, did exactly what he wanted. he knew the drill. He totally ignored the producer.
Then I've got a note here which suggests that Philip came down on the Bisco, in fact.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, there you are. Well, the new Bisco or the old?
I don't know.
I don't know.
That could be incorrect. Again, it's coming from Fuchs.
Well, I don't, because if that was early 57, no, it wouldn't have been. It would have been the old Bisco, because the old Bisco didn't, new one didn't appear till the following season.
Yeah.
And it was probably being built at that time.
Yeah. So did you speak to him?
Yes. Yeah. Hello, sir. No, goodbye. Hello,
it,
goodbye,
it?
Shake hands.
So was it a bit of a damp squib then?
Yeah, it was a bit of a non-event, really. He was doing what was protocol asked of him. Didn't look as though he was particularly enjoying it, but then again, it just comes with the territory. You can't always do things you want to do when you're in that position. But he was polite and that, and I can't remember any questions being asked.
Did you ever get off base at all, George?
A base what?
Did you get off base much?
Only the once. When I went, when Ron Tapp and I went manholing, it was a time I mentioned where Joe Farman went through the ice.
Yeah.
But he and I, we had to take a rather tortuous route to get to the depot on the mainland. Why it was placed there, I don't know, whether it was an emergency depot. if I remember right, because we couldn't get ashore directly to the depot because the inshore ice was a bit fragile. So we had to offload everything, including the sledge, and take it across country to a, can't remember how far, to the depot. And I don't know why it concerned us, but when we checked the fuel there, it was supposed to be paraffin, so memory serves me, and it was terps. And I can't see that paraffin would have survived the coldest temperatures anyway without going waxy. So I don't, it might be something, an aberrism in my memory that makes me think. But when we came to leave the next day, having survived a cataphatic wind coming down the glacier, we loaded up, had to take everything back like we had to backtrack and load up on the ice and set off. And I don't know what it was, made me look back, but where the sledge runners had been was open water.
Already? Gosh.
It was it was just going straight through the ice. So we just sort of sprouted wings and flew across the ice and eventually got to firm ice. And then we were on our way back anyway, then just headed straight back to base. But that was a near-death experience, you might say, really. It was the closest I've come to it. And I thought, well, somebody up somewhere has got some further use for me to keep me going.
So would that just have been purely recreation, that trip? Or?
In a sense, yeah. I mean, see, with the second year, it was decided that everybody who wanted to at some time could have a weekend break or something like that. Now, down just up the creek from the base was the old British Grahamland expedition of 1935, something like that. So Jerry Cutland and Evan Rowland Hughes went up and stayed there for a couple of nights in their sleeping bags. I don't know what they did for food. I don't know. They survived anyway. And Ron and I decided to try something useful, and then Stanley asked us to give them ice reports, which we were able to do from hard-earned experience.
Did you ever get any other visits apart from Prince Philip?
Yes, inadvertently, but we were running short of fuel for the outboard, and we knew that some distance, what I call up river, but up the channel, there was an Argentine, you could call it a base, but it was very, very small. And we knew that the Catalinas used to fly in and out, and there would possibly be aviation fuel there. So off we set with an empty drum, 40-gallon drum, out there, and landed on the beach. And who should come down the beach to meet us but three Argentinian army folk. And there was us innocently carrying an empty 40-gallon drum with us. Anyway, no problem. We said, can we possibly scrounge a bit of fuel? Help yourself. And then they treated us like royal. They gave us their version of a barbecue because they had plenty of beef. And then I don't think Jerry Cutler must have been there as well. Anyway, in the event, Jerry spent a couple of days with them, and two of them came because rank has its privileges. There was a lieutenant, a sergeant, and a private. So, except for the private, the other two had somebody to be in charge of. And so, I think the private was left behind, and they came back for Christmas, I think, because obviously the ice was open, otherwise we wouldn't have got there. They came back for Christmas, and Jerry stayed there with his private. And then they swapped over, and Jerry brought the private back for a couple of days, and we got on like a house on fire.
So they came to your hut?
They came to Galinda's, yeah.
And Jerry cooked for them?
Yes, yeah. And they cooked a barbecue for, well, there must have been three of us that went over there, you know, originally. But so that was our introduction to the Argentinians, and I say we couldn't have been friendlier.
Did you have to deliver any protest notes?
No. I believe that was a privilege of places like Hope Bay and that, where they were on the same, within spitting distance of each other, really. But obviously, I don't know whether how true it is, but the story is that, say, the British would go over and deliver a protest note 1 week, and then they'd have a party. And a month later, the Geneva Accord deliver a protest note, and they'd have another party.
Did the governor come down? I think he must have come down with Prince Philip, didn't he?
No, we had no visitors like that. Say, Prince Philip was the only one of any note who came to visit us, really. Another thing that just come to mind is the fact that I can remember when I first arrived there, and as you know, that they used to deliver a couple of carcasses of lamb or mutton. Well, I don't know which it was. We say lamb anyway. And they served it up for a roast, fat and all. And I'm a bit of a Jack Sprat, or I was then. And I couldn't understand why the people from the previous year wanted second helpings. At the end of the first year, I was first in the queue for second helpings. And you realise how much you miss the fresh produce, you know, fresh with new real potatoes and vegetables and the fresh meat.
You were having to do a lot of physical work, weren't you?
Yes.
On not the best rations.
No. Well, I would say they used to put bowls of vitamin tablets on the dining table, but I don't think anybody ever used them. We were fit as 10, really. I mean, see, it was. I don't say that's always the case at all bases, but it was by instinct, or intuition, or what. But Jerry served up meals that were nutritious, really, and that's why I say possibly one of the reasons why we stayed together. But yes, it was a. I would imagine if you were sledging a lot, then it was a greater demand on you, really. The only physical work that we had was maybe bringing out the coal, bringing out the fuel and what have you. And, of course, recreation, the skiing, was exercise in itself, really.
So tell me about the skiing, then. How far could you get?
Not very far. In the winter, if the ice was firm, you could go just as far as you wanted to, really, or as far as was safe, or as far as you were allowed. We used to go across, I can't remember the name of the island, but I know it had Charcot's Cairn on it, and that was a cormorant, a rookery, if you like, there. But as far as skiing was concerned, we had the two islands, Galindus and another small one, up by the OBG base up. But largely it was trudge your way up to the top of Galindus and point your skis downhill and away you went. And you'd find some steeper slope and try to do some fancy turns and a few Christies here and a few Christies here. Pick yourself up and then carry on.
Had you skied before?
No.
So you learnt on site, did you?
Oh, yes, yeah. I think we all did. The only one who might have done it, I mentioned his name again, was Joe Farman. And he tried a few fancy things, and when he decided that maybe he didn't know as much as he thought. And so he practised the same as the rest of us.
He's become quite a famous figure, hasn't he,
With the black hole in the ozone layer.
Well, yeah.
Yes. Yes, I don't know whether it was how much he was directly involved. I mean, see, how the hole was discovered, was it on inspecting the data that had come from there, or whether somebody down there said, this is a funny reading? So whether it's, how much Joe was actually involved in it, I don't know.
Well, he was head of the team.
He was head of a team, yes.
I suppose my question is, knowing him earlier in the 50s, did you spot anything in him which may suggest he was going to become a prominent scientist?
No. I mean, see, that's one thing. He was one of the lads, shall we say. And this is it. I mean, see, he adjusted in that respect. I think that, you know, the university atmosphere that he'd been used to in the previous year, because I imagine he was not long postgraduate. I don't know, because he wasn't that old. So he's postgraduate. And so he was disillusioned in a few ways, I think, with mixing with people.
How do you mean?
Well, as I say, you know, he was quite surprised that I liked classical music, because he got the impression that I was not up to that standard.
Right.
So did he
muck in then on bass? Or
well, he had no choice.
Right.
He had no choice at all. He wouldn't have got four otherwise. He'd have been off bass otherwise. No, he was all right, Joe. He was all right. He joined in. He did. It's just that he didn't quite have my twisted sense of humour, maybe, but he was all right.
Apart from the skiing, were there other recreational activities?
No.
Did you have a library?
Well, music, I suppose, really. I can remember coming through Montevideo buying a few LPs, Stan Kenton, and when I got down there, his Christian name, Skilling, the Diesel Mac, he was a Stan Kenton fan, and at the end of the first year, he said, "Would you do a swap?" So I forget what I took in return, but he wanted to take Stan Kenton with him, so he did. But a lot of the old records were old 78s, which came in useful because we didn't have any ski wax. I don't think we had anyway. So Ron Tapp was very innovative. He broke up some 78 records, dissolved them in paraffin, painted that onto the ski runners, and when it set, you had a plastic coated ski.
Didn't play tunes as you skied along.
No. But I thought that was so innovative, really. But what gave him the idea, whether he'd done it before, I don't know. But it certainly worked anyway. I mean, it wore off, but then he just took another 78 that he didn't like and broke it up.
Were there other innovations?
We did recreation, yes. Let me see. It was a daily thing. We had a game of Scrabble and I think we had a game of Hand of Bridge. It was Bridge and Scrabble.
Did you have a dictionary for the Scrabble?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That was supplied by Fids, I think. But, yeah, I'm going to say it didn't. Yeah. I don't think who used to play with that. No. But, yeah, that was it. You couldn't go a day without a game of Scrabble and a game of Bridge, Hand of Bridge.
I'm surprised Scrabble was around in those days.
Sure it was something like that. Because, yeah.
Oh, yes, I'm sure it was. So I was asking whether there were any other innovations, like the boiling down the records or any other flashes of inspiration you recall.
Well, something that was strictly illegal. I'm sure that the digital mechanic taught me. And that was trying to crank up a twin cylinder Lister and get it going was very difficult. So we used to take the air cleaner off, put an old cigarette tin with a bit of cotton waste in it, set fire to it, and crank over, and then start it that way, and then whip the cigarette tin on and put the air cleaner back on.
So the cigarette tin was a source of warmth, was it?
No, it's on fire.
Right.
So it was more, not so much spark ignition, but it certainly wasn't compression ignition.
Oh, right.
So that was one thing I taught, but I don't think it was recommended necessarily. And again, I don't know what you'd call it, innovation, but at the end of the second year, we had to build a generator hut. Up to then, we'd had a twin cylinder Lister, or two twin cylinders for the main power, and a single cylinder one to supply power to the magnetic hut. And the idea was that this new generator shed would house a water-cooled three-cylinder electric starter Lister. A chap came down, Gashand, I suppose, but he'd been something in construction anyway. So he knew how to use a theodolite, but he didn't have a surveyor's theodolite. All he had was a Met Office theodolite that we used for chucking balloons. But he used it anyway, in one way or another, to line up all the pillars for the for the cross pieces, for the foundations, for the hut. And I thought that was very clever how he did it. He must have had the stand on his head because, believe me, a Metropolis theodolite is nothing like any other theodolite. But that was innovative as well. So I don't know how much cement we mixed then. I don't know.
What was your living accommodation like? Talk me through the hut.
Well, the dormitory, it had a stove in it, but I think we were too afraid of carbon monoxide poisoning that we never lit it.
Really?
Well, it was never efficient, and it did leak fumes and what have you, and that's nothing you could do about it. So we went to bed with sea boot stockings, duffel coat, and my bed was right next to a window, and fortunately it had frozen over, because if it started off, the snow used to come and drift in, but eventually that melted and froze, and so I was windproof. But yes, it was cold. You had to go really wrapped up with duffels on and all the rest of it. You couldn't. But it was comfortable, no bother at all, no bother.
Hot water bottles?
Oh no, I didn't have that luxury at all. You came in the back door. On the left was the generator room. On the right was a workshop, in which there was a potbelly stove, which heated the water. In the next room on the right, which was the bathroom, heated the water in the tank there. We had a tin bath, which were on tap again, plumbed in, instead of having to, instead of having, so that you just pull the plug and it went out underneath the hut.
Where did it go to?
Well, it just evaporated outside. It went underneath the hut, and the hut was on pillars anyway. So that was all right.
But it was, surely it would have frozen, wouldn't it?
Oh, it froze, yeah, yes. But I dare say, when it went out warm, it probably spread for a while. And anyway, it never present. I know what you mean. Did it gradually build up and lift the rod off? But it was only while, whatever he did at the first or second year, I can't remember. But so we never had more than a year, and like 6 months, if you like. And then, of course, because in the summer, with all the snow largely disappearing, the temperature got up into the teens, up to about 10 Celsius, 50 Fahrenheit, something like that. But anyway,
So what did he do for water supply in the summer then?
Well, this is it. In the winter, you went out. One of the jobs was, if it was your turn to have a bath, you finished. If you're sensible, you cut blocks of snow and piled them outside the door of the hut. And when you'd had your bath, you went and filled the tank up again with these. In the summer, the same was the case. The snow was very porous by then, with melting snow. So if you lifted a block, it could easily fall apart in you. So you usually left a trail of broken snow behind you. But it was the same thing. It was the only thing you could do, really.
But you had to go further to get the snow, did you?
Not too far, actually. I mean, see, it was... It built up quite a bit outside the hut, outside one of the doors, the back door, as I called it, and because that was a path down to our jetty, and so the banks built up to about 5 or 6 feet, so that kept us going quite. And then the summer, of course, it was always replaced. I think there's somebody looking for me in a minute, Chris. I'm going to have to stop. I don't know if we see anyway. See if the doorbell goes. But it was, you're only talking about less than 6 months, really, without any snow. And so it built up. So we lasted out anyway. But it got a bit borderline at times. We could have got more, but it would have been a question of maybe chopping some ice rather than water.
Was there a shower facility?
No. Well, like I say, one of my other jobs that I didn't share, apart from the meteorology, was I was quartermaster the first year. And so Jerry used to give me the stock book every year, what he wanted for the week, and I would go up and divvy it out. The only thing I was not allowed to touch was anything alcohol-based, because the base leader locked that away in his office, and it never appeared we accepted his behest. And so any party was the parties that he said we could have. And every week there would be your rations for the week, so in a way of chocolate and beer and maybe cigarettes. And if they were not gone by 11 o'clock that night, you never saw them again. So he did not endear himself very much to the crew, if you like.
Is this the first year or the second year?
The first year.
This was the RAF man, wasn't it?
Yeah. And the second year, David Emerson, coming in base leader, asked me to carry on and take control of everything. I think possibly in the first year, the base leader was worried that people would abuse the alcoholies. But the problem was that when he had a party and put some out, they made up for it. So they were more likely to overindulge then than if they'd had. So for no particular philosophy of mine, I put out a bottle of each spirit and a crate of beer. And at the end of the month, it was virtually untouched. But if you came in after a particularly hard day, you could have a spontaneous party and relieve the atmosphere. And it was the same with the cigarettes. I mean, see, you had your ration of cigarettes previously, and if you didn't, and that was it. And so at the end of the first year, we had built up such a surplus of unused cigarettes. And sometimes you used to go down to the BGE hut where there was old tins of tobacco and toilet paper and rolled cigarettes out of toilet paper. then people were, the smokers were that desperate, you know. So again, they used to come in boxes of 10 tins of 50 cigarettes. And I think it was three brands. So I used to put, or four brands, I used to put four boxes out, which are 2,000 cigarettes. And they hardly touched. If you treat them like children, they'll behave like children.
Where were all these stores kept? Were they outdoors or?
Oh, upstairs in the loft.
Right.
So, as I say, there was only one miscreant in the first year who got a bit light-fingered with the alcohol. But who shall remain nameless. But other than that, it was quite safe. We used to under the seats in the dining room, there was where the week's supplies were stored. So Jerry would give me a list and I'd get it all down and put it away and what have you. And then, of course, at the end of the year, I had to make the list out and send it off as to what we wanted to bring it up to stock for the next 18 months.
Were there some stores kept outside? And you had to dig things out of the snow?
No. Well, coal was, which was a bane of our lives. We had a coal, we had an indoor coal house, but you couldn't hold so much coal. Well, the bags froze. Froze absolutely rock hard. And trying to open the sacks was bad enough, but then you had to try to separate the individual coals, if you like, to do it. So it was a question of bringing the bags inside where the temperature was enough above freezing that they would thaw out so that you could empty them out into the hold, if you like. So that was it. And so that was somebody's job, was it to keep the coal scuttles full as well. And of course, you had it with the observations being 24 hours, every 3 hours, you had a fire watch at night, and that was served a dual purpose as well. Because I think, was it Deception or Admiralty burnt down?
Admiralty.
Admiralty, yeah. Certainly, as I say, sending in the orders for that, it was 18 months, supposedly, that if anything went wrong and a boat ship couldn't get in at the end of the year, you only had 6 months supply, but with judicious rationing, you could last out the year.
You mentioned going to the British Grahamland expedition hut.
Yes.
What kind of condition was that in?
Shambles. It was drifting snow had got inside. It was virtually, that would go in the summer, but it was, nothing had been done to preserve it at all. Say there was some sort of stuff. I don't know whether there were any food supplies there, but there was the tobacco I mentioned and toilet paper. That was the only relic. I can't believe that it was relics of 1935, the toilet paper, but it might well have been, I don't know.
Have they left anything else? They left books or...
No, it was stripped.
Clothing?
It was stripped as far as that was concerned. Nothing at all. I don't know how long the exhibition was. I imagine possibly a year. But at that time, of course, there was no fears of anything happening down there. Obviously, part of the reason for FIDS was to deny Germans access to the bases or to the land, if you like. Though, I think it was pre-war, but the, I forget what the name of the ship was. A German naval vessel went down there and it carried a flying boat. And they flew over the base and dropped over the Grahamland and dropped hundreds of swastikas.
Did you ever see one of these?
Eh?
Did you ever see one of these?
No. That was a gone by. This must have been pre-war. So by the time FIDS started up, that was 10 years, and nothing lasts long in 10 years, you know. Obviously, you think of flags, they wouldn't last. You know, they'd be in tatters and gone by then in all the wind and snow. Yeah. So what they hoped to achieve by whether the swastikas were supposed to lay claim to Grahamland, I don't know.
Did you ever feel any attachment or kindredship with the pioneering era, the Scott and Shackleton? And...
Well, Shackleton is a hero of mine, definitely. I mean,
why is that?
Well, I read the book Endurance, and that really sort of imprinted it on my mind. And down there, I could imagine all that he'd done, you know, and then getting icebound and what have you, and then trekking. It was just absolutely marvellous what he did, I think, really. I think Scott was weighed down by the, not saying the wrong thing, by the scientific side of it. It's like Fuchs crossing the Antarctic. He wasn't going to race Hillary because he was there. It was a scientific expedition. And really, that's what Scott was the same. So his mistake was trying to do the two things at once, really. And he relied on modern equipment like tractors and what have you, whereas the tried and tested ones of Amundsen, the hot dogs, and so there we are. Yeah.
When it began to be time to think about leaving, what were you thinking about? What were your feelings?
Well, I knew not so much at the time. I suppose excitement. I can't say I was sorry to leave because, my colleagues, Jerry and Ron, were going at the same time. Was Roger Todd White there the 2 years? I can't remember. I think he was, yes. So it wasn't that so much. But when we got to Montevideo, I got the question, I wish I had thought of that. Because Wally Herbert and a few others decided to disembark and work their way up through South America and North America. And as I say, in hindsight, well, everything else that happened after that wouldn't have slotted into place for me. So I can't come out. But I can see, I think I'd have enjoyed that, but it never even occurred to me. And of course, Wally went on to the greater things, didn't he?
You came back out on the new Bisco.
Yes, the first trip voyage of the Bisco, and that was different again because, as I say, on the Shackleton we had two to a cabin. I know I forget that, and I'll tell you later on off here. And coming home, we had a single to a cabin. Going down, in a sense, we worked our passage because as a meteorologist, I had to do what I did observations from the ship, which were usually done by the deck officers. Coming back, and some of them did took over the steering wheel, helmsman, coming back, we were, you know, we were indulged, and we didn't have to do anything. Just came back, apart from cross the line.
Yeah. You had occasion to look out of the portal once.
Oh, that yes, that was when we first joined the new Bisco at Base F to come home. And I was allocated my cabin. I went in. I thought, I'll let some fresh air in. And I opened the portal and stuck my head out and looked down the length of the ship. And there, a few caverns along, was another porthole open and a head poking out. And he turned to me and said, have they locked you in as well? And I understand that afterwards that seemingly he flipped. Whether it was the isolation or what, but something or other had got to him and he just flipped. But he's a lovely bloke, but they had to, for his own safety, they'd at least then. Now, whether they let him out, I can't remember, whether they let him out later on. I imagine they did, under supervision. But at that time, of course, with everybody coming and going, you couldn't be sure that he wouldn't do something silly. Yeah.
What do you regard as being your key achievement in your years in the Antarctic?
Surviving the 2 years. It's one thing. Learning to ski the hard way, making friends, making comrades, which was a new experience. Even when I was in the RAF, they were workmates, they were friends, but it was a different thing altogether down there. You were comrades. That's what I found anyway. And I think that bore fruit in later life.
How do you mean?
Well, I like to think when I had staff under me that I treated them as comrades rather than just part of the workforce.
So your man management skills were improved by your Antarctic experiences?
Definitely, definitely. And I like to think that approach got the best out of them. You know, I didn't really have to ask much. If I suggested something you'd do, and you'd get a volunteer just like that. You know, and yeah. So it certainly benefited. It changed me from a boy into a man, I like to think. Put it that way. It's a youngster in that. It came out a lot wiser, I think.
So looking back over a substantial lifetime, how do the Antarctic years rate as in your life?
Something I've never regretted, a highlight of my career. It was the highlight, without a doubt. I mean, say weather ships I still enjoyed, but it was a job. But Antarctic wasn't a job. It wasn't a job. It was a paid holiday. I like to think of it as that anyway.
Better not let Bass hear you say that.
Well, of course, they don't go down for... They don't winter it anymore.
Well, what do you feel about the changes these days? It is completely different, isn't it? Now?
Well, I mean, see, Rothera winters, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Is that the only one?
No, Halley and Rothera. But they're only small teams.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, if you like, a lot of the work, the spade work, was done. When there are 11 bases, the focus has changed now. The surveying's over. Now it's all scientific, they've got to work on the data they've acquired. So it makes sense to bring them back and let them do it in the UK. But I would like to think that all of them at some time got at least one winter in to see what... I think they would maybe view it with a slightly different perspective if they wintered. I do. I think, you know, you can't say you've been to the Antarctic until you've wintered. And I know it's an old, I know, rather hackneyed view, but I think so anyway. But anyway, they're still doing a sterling job. How many are there now in Bassett? Probably more than there were when there were 11 bases, is it?
I don't know precisely, but I know There's about 30 people winter across the two bases.
Yeah.
Just keeping the bases going, really.
Yeah, well, we had... The establishment was 11, and the first year we had 9, because we didn't have the two scientists. And that was the biggest base, I think, just about, with a full complement, 11. So if you said there were 11 bases and the average was about 8, there's still about 80, 90 people right now.
It's been a great pleasure, George. Thank you.
Well, so thank much. You. Thank you. And I shall go and do a Google of RGY, and I will go and do a Google of a few other things, I think, now. And I shall await with interest, with keen interest, as to when... You say some of it is archived, is available already?
Let's just stop the recording.